A wiry man of indiscernible age, wearing ill-fitting clothing and holding a watering can, was standing inside a patch of dust-covered vegetables. He set the can down and came forward to meet them. Jian hailed him with, "Long live Chairman Mao," and introduced Sparrow and Kai as the celebrated musicians they had discussed the previous night. The wiry man nodded.
"You've suddenly materialized," said Comrade Glass-Eye. "Like the traveling musical troops who visited in the first years of our great republic."
Even his voice was thin, as if his vocal cords were made of reeds. He studied them with both lightness and weariness. Sparrow reached into his bag and withdrew a bulky package. He presented their host with a carton of front gate cigarettes, a bottle of cognac, and a bag of white rabbit sweets, which Ba Lut had given him to ease his journey through the province, calling them the new currency of the Republic. "Gifts for Comrade Glass-Eye," Sparrow said, trying not to drop the bottle, which was sliding out from between his fingertips. The man's head bobbed as he graciously accepted the gifts.
"Very few people know me by that name," he said. "Locally, I'm called Ai Di Sheng, after Thomas Edison, of course, because of my experiments with electricity. The villagers mean it as a joke, but a friendly joke. Sometimes the children and the drunkards called me Teacher Sui Ren, the fabled creator of fire. I guess I have been called many things. My workshop is just over there. Come in, please."
He turned and began walking quickly towards the door beneath the second gable, the gifts rustling against his oversized shirt. Sparrow had to jog to keep up. Quietly, Comrade Glass-Eye said to him,
"Who instructed you to search for me by that name?"
"My uncle, known as Wen the Dreamer." The man showed no expression, but kept on walking, balancing his gifts. A wooden door opened without a creak or complaint, and then a lamp hissed on, although the man had touched nothing. Sparrow, Kai, and Jian followed him inside. They dodged an enormous glass fishing buoy, climbed three steps, and entered a room with a single long table and a wall of shelves. Wires of light began to gleam, as if awoken by their movements. Comrade Glass-Eye put his gifts down. He gestured towards the full yet uncluttered room and said,
"You're welcome to look around."
"Teacher," Kai said, "is your main interest light?"
"It was," the man said. "But when I returned from re-education, I discovered that my supply of copper wires was gone. During the Great Leap Forward, people broke down my door and carried away all the metal. You remember the slogan? Struggle to produce 10.7 million tons of steel. When Chairman Mao instructed the villages to industrialize, my neighbors discovered all my bits and pieces, even my voltage meter, my collection of batteries, pinhole cameras and metal coils, not to mention my cooking pots and metal spoons, and fed them to the smelter that you'll see if you walk 50 paces to the east of here. They managed to produce a surprising quantity of steel, but sadly, none of it was usable."
He shrugged, and one of the electric lights fizzled, dimmed, and then gleamed brightly again.
"Upon my release, my neighbors all came and said, 'Isn't it a shame, Teacher Edison? You weren't here to help us fulfill our steel quota.' And then I was glad that I hadn't been present to hand over all my spatulas and wires, as well as my mother's wedding ring and the German Stein my father brought from Düsseldorf many years ago. as well as my bicycle. Sometimes it's better not to say goodbye."
The man paused for breath and to consider the long table which held only a few items.
"Come and look at my eyes," he said.
He lifted out a cabinet, set it before them, and slid open a drawer that curved to the side like a hidden wing, laid out on a notched paper surface in even rows of 8. Were eyes. Another light crackled on automatically. The eyes were ordered in a spectrum from black to chestnut irises, each with a subtle interweaving of lines, fissures, and depths. They were hollow half-spheres made to fit, the man said, over the non-working eye, or over a sphere which had been implanted in the socket.
"These are for the right side,"
he said. He slid open the second drawer, which extended in the opposite direction. 40 further glass eyes appeared.
"And these are for the left. Each one is paired to another, but I prefer to store them separately."
Sparrow inched closer, hypnotized by the play of colors and the unreal, discomforting feeling of the eyes moving over him. "It seems like yesterday," said Jian, who had been silent until now, "that I first met teacher Ai Di Sheng in this very room. I had lost my eye when my best friend, in a regrettable moment, punched me in the face. How could I lose my eye over something so inconsequential? Afterward, I couldn't eat or sleep properly, and when I looked at my reflection, all I saw was the empty socket, as if my entire self was being funneled into that small, ugly opening. All night, I would sit in my dark room and play my violin, and its voice was the only thing that comforted me. Only music could express my pure feeling. I was broken by the loss of that eye. My best friend, who had hit me unintentionally, and who also felt shame when he looked at my face, discovered teacher Edison. So, one day, I found my way here. We sat at this table, face to face, and we spoke about vision, one-sidedness, and the double nature of life. He asked me whether a glass eye would be for myself or for my best friend. In other words, did I yearn for a new eye as a window to the outside world, or for the world to look in on me? Well, I was very depressed, and both perspectives struck me as equally valid. After all, when I remember my past, I see myself as if from the outside. I perceive myself as another person might. So, we came to the conclusion that eyes are not one-sided. Teacher Edison lectured me for a long time. He said that a glass eye could not be a replacement for the lost one, but rather a new addition. Neither a blindfold nor a seeing eye, but a painted mirror. "Please," I said, "I don't care what it is. If you can help me, you must. I feel as if I've been cut in two." And so, over many days, he painted my first prosthetic. It was a chestnut brown, with flecks of orange and a hint of gold, which, he said, was the nature of my seeing eye. One day, on a sunny morning, just like today, we put it in for the first time. After the long wait and my impatience, I refused to look in the mirror. I was afraid of the devil I might see. What if my reflection turned out to be a monster? A new self, even more hideous than before. But he ignored my tears and fixed the eye in place. Jian closed both eyes and seemed to hold his breath. And then he opened them, looking directly at Sparrow. "When I finally looked into the mirror, I saw myself, as if for the first time, as a human being like any other. It is just an eye, such a small thing, but... He turned towards the very thin man. I think it's almost time for a new eye, comrade. Comrade Glasseye assessed the violinist's face.
As we get older, he said, the color of the iris fades. So perhaps you are right, and the color could come down a degree.
So you see, said Jian, we two are like brothers. On the long table, Sparrow took in a delicate set of glass tubes, a Bunsen burner, miniature jars of paint, and slender paintbrushes that seemed to have only a single hair.
I have a spare room, Comrade Glasseye said. Just through here, if you, my friends, wish to stay a few nights with me. It is a simple but welcoming place.
Under the electric lamps, both of the man's eyes seemed like painted objects, peculiar, shining with a mystery of their own. Before Sparrow could answer, Kai said,
We would be glad to, teacher.
The thin man clapped his hands, making them all jump.
And you, old Jin, come and keep an old fool company.
I brought my violin, Jin said, and young Sparrow plays the erhu.
Then you must come and see my musical instruments, if you follow me this way.
That night, it stormed. As Sparrow played for them, the tap-tap of rain needles percolated into the music, interfering with the notes, muffling some and enlarging others, as if the downpour had a mind of its own and conducted the entire field of sound within and without the two-gabled house. Comrade Glasseye served a muddy, sweetened coffee that he said came from the Buddhist lands of the southern seas, followed by a rice wine Jian said came from the western borders of Turkmenistan. In the corner of the room was a small harpsichord, so thin and earth-toned that Sparrow had not even realized it was there. He lifted the cover, revealing a Latin inscription.
Music, Comrade Glasseye translated, is a solace of great labors. So, young man, he said, turning to Kai, won't you play for us? Teacher Sparrow has told us that you are a divine pianist.
Kai tried to say he was merely ordinary, but they would not hear of it. Finally, he sat down on the rickety wooden bench. He began to play a Bach cantata, transcribed for keyboard, the Octus Tragicus. Sparrow had the feeling of descending a sunlit staircase. The libretto rose up to meet him. Ah, Lord, teach us to think that we might die so that we might become wise. Put your house in order, my child, for you will die and no longer remain among the living. The priests in Kai's village must have owned a harpsichord, for the pianist played as if it were his own. He ingeniously folded the music in half and then half again, emerging at the third movement with a chorus unexpectedly rapt with joy. Today, today, you will be with me in paradise. And from this height, a place best described as Kula, a state containing both joy and sorrow, the music began to tumble down, suddenly blending into Sparrow's own unfinished Symphony No. 3. Kai had only heard it the one time, but now he played it from memory. The transition astonished Sparrow. The notes simultaneously faltered and climbed, faltered and lifted. The music seemed cast in an unknown and unimagined hue, so that Sparrow felt as if he were hearing his own composition for the first time. When the movement ended, Comrade Glasseye shook his head.
But what music is this that reminds me of things I once knew?
He began, drunkenly, to remember the camps of the Northwest.
"Was it so much to ask?"
he said.
"To be allowed to live one's own life, honoring one's parents, and raising one's children to the best of one's ability? Why is so simple a life the most difficult to obtain?"
The portraits of Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai, and Lin Biao assessed them like busybody neighbors.
"Poor teacher Edison," cried Tian, leaping to his feet. Sparrow feared the walls were listening, and he wanted to say it was only music, but could not bring himself to voice words so patently untrue. Kai paused to let the audience settle. The pianist gulped down a full glass of the Turkmenistan wine and caught Sparrow's eye with a sad, helpless smile. He began playing again as the rain fell harder, sweeping them all away from Wuhan, from the county, the province, and even the earth itself, until everything swayed, including the tremor of Kai's music. They focused exclusively on the sixth and seventh bottles, and Sparrow experienced a delirious freedom of thought and freedom of movement. The doors exhaled, and covers of beds swept open to welcome them, and Sparrow listened to the deluge while Kai held him clumsily in his arms.
"How could you play my symphony so perfectly?" he asked.
Kai answered, "How could you think I would forget it?"
They fell asleep this way, touching without fully touching, near and far away, satiated and yet full of yearning. Sparrow was the first to wake. He heard the rattle of a truck on the broken road outside and became aware of Kai slowly falling off the narrow bed. Gently, he pulled the unconscious pianist back onto the mat and covered him. The young man murmured in his sleep and said, "Dear Sparrow." And Sparrow felt for the first time how the purest joy could be a heaviness. He lay quietly, the wine now aching in his head, and listened to a noise from outside, the sharp note of a spade tapping stone. He pulled on his clothes and went out. In the dusty garden patch, Comrade Glasseye was on his knees, occupied by something just emerging from the ground.
"He arrives,"
Comrade Glasseye said, addressing the plants.
"The nephew of Win the Dreamer, a renowned composer as if from another time and age."
Aided by Sparrow, he slowly got to his feet.
"Let me show you the furnace our village built during the Great Leap Forward, a model of ingenuity,"
he said, frowning. They began to walk away from the house, sloping down a hill towards a line of softly whistling trees. Sparrow saw the smelter Comrade Glasseye had spoken of, a misshapen black hat rising up from the dirt, abandoned.
"There it is. May it stand for eternity,"
Comrade Glasseye said, nearly shouting. Then his voice dropped low.
"A rumor says that Wen the Dreamer is no longer at the camp."
Sparrow nodded.
"If you've come all this way to inquire after him,"
the older man said,
"I know nothing of his whereabouts. I am very sorry."
They were not moving quickly. Comrade Glasseye favored the right side of his body, and his forehead shone with the effort of hiding his physical pain. It seemed clear to Sparrow that the inventor was gravely ill.
"Teacher, let's stop here to rest."
"No need, no need."
And then, even more softly,
"I'll feel better away from the house. There are spies everywhere. I'm afraid I was rather foolish with my words last night."
Sparrow nodded. He turned to look back, half expecting the doors and windows to have tottered after them.
When the dreamer had a suitcase,
Comrade Glass-Eye said, after they had been walking for some time.
A very important suitcase. It held a clean set of clothes, a picture of his wife, and their little girl. What was her name?
Julie, Sparrow said.
Of course, Julie.
I received a letter from him. The old man seemed not to hear. His eyes were glassy in the sun, and then they were suddenly wet. Tears fell and mixed with the man's sweat, and only then did Sparrow know that Comrade Glass-Eye had understood.
Our friend is not only a fine calligrapher,
the man whispered,
but an escape artist of the highest rank. Where does a person hide in the desert? It's like a fish trying to hide in a tree.
He stopped to turn away, lifting his hands to his face. He said from behind the shelter,
I've seen men leave this world midway through a sentence. If I tell you what we live through, would you believe me?
His hands descended.
If I told you that all through the bitter winter, we lived inside caves. What would you say? That good men, educated and honest men, had to copy the ways of animals in order to survive the climate. But we were not animals. We were missing sharp teeth and pointed ears and thick fur coats. We and all our men starved. Comrade Sparrow, I'm going to tell you the truth about these camps. I'm a very old man, and if it turns out you're a spy, I've nothing to lose but myself. I can't betray one, because I've no idea where he's gone. I only hope he took the suitcase with him.
I promise you, Sparrow said. I'll keep all our secrets. The old man nodded. He was already half-submerged in his own memories.
The year I met Wynne the Dreamer,
Comrade Glass-Eye said.
There was famine everywhere. In 1958, during the Great Leap Forward, the true face of our revolution was revealed. Why did our leaders dream that every farmer could be reborn as a steelmaker? How did they imagine that a boy who had studied the fields all his life, could make iron ore out of nothing. I think it is much more serious than ideology, production and material needs. We had to become only what they proclaimed us to be. We existed to be forged and reforged by the party. Here, in this village, the communal kitchen was shut down for lack of food. The ground and the trees were stripped bare. Nobody had a pot to cook their soup in, let alone soup itself. In 6 months, half the people starved. First the children and the old, and then the rest. It was a pitiful death, this useless wasting away. And it was a silent famine, because few in the city knew what was happening in the countryside. All they knew was that food enough was coming in through the proper channels. All the grain had been requisitioned, you see. They took it away and left the countryside with nothing.
He nodded his head and turned his face to the undulating line of land and air, to the gray mountains in the distance.
In the northwest, our own famine was a catastrophe. We had no ceremonies. What can the party say at the funeral of a convicted rightist? To them, he had already died long ago. But I was fortunate in my gifts. If I may say so, hunger inspired my most ingenious creations. Over time, your uncle became my tall and trusted assistant. One the Dreamer and I made pulleys and tools out of nothing more than the desert wind. Every storehouse can be broken into. Every camp administrator's private quarters. Every cook's kitchen. If you have the right hands and the right tools.
Dreaming One could reach the highest windows.
He could stretch like an expanding ladder. We had a motto, Brother One and I, not to waste anything in the wastelands. We ingested compost, animal feed. We welcomed any nutrient under the sun. From the party to our stomachs. From the son of Chairman Mao to our lips. We promised ourselves that we would seek out the last edible crumb on this empty plate and find a way to eat the plate itself, if necessary. There would be no slow death for us, only a slow regeneration. Every day we woke up and cursed our leaders, the revolution and history, and we worshipped life, learning in the future. Do you know why I was sentenced to re-education through labor, young Sparrow?
He smiled, as if he was about to tell a long and satisfying joke.
Let me digress and offer you this tale within a tale. Well, my crime begins with my mother. During the Civil War, she left my father and ran away with a nationalist soldier, a fighter for Chiang Kai-shek. My father, it must be said, was not the easiest man. He used to fall asleep wearing his own shorts on his head to keep out the cold, and when he woke in the morning, he would forget they were there and go out into the village just as he had gone to sleep. My mother, meanwhile, was the brightest star in the village, intelligent, kind, and lovely, and 20 years younger than him. Her nationalist lover was, in fact, a childhood friend. Just as the Civil War was breathing its last, he crept back to the village under cover of night. They disappeared together. Chairman Mao was all but leader by then. My father feared my mother would be caught, charged with sedition and executed. He couldn't sleep, and became so worried that he wasted away, as if he himself was on the run. But one morning, a letter arrived from my mother. She told us she had followed her lover and General Chiang Kai-shek out of the country, and into exile in Taiwan. And so, she was gone forever. I knew my mother loved me as much as she loved her sweetheart. Thus she would never be happy separated from him or me. One thing I've learned, dear Sparrow, is that light is never still and solid. And so it is with love. Light can be split into many directions. Its nature is to break apart. My mother only wrote to me the once. I never heard from her again, but I kept that letter all my teenaged years, and I felt her suffering and believed that she felt mine. We were connected, as surely as this blade of grass is attached to the soil below. My father's love for her, meanwhile, was set to flow ever more towards her, no matter where she went or what she did. And it burned brightly until the end of his brief and patient life. Anyhow, by 1955 I was a bachelor and an orphan, and the chairman chose this moment to launch his brightest campaign. Let 100 flowers bloom, he told us. Let 100 schools of thought contend. We were told we must question ourselves, our superiors, and the state of our nation so as to make a country that was both unified and just.
Young Sparrow, I had spent too long in my workshop, alone with my crystal radios, homemade batteries, and amplifiers, in a closed room where inanimate objects listened to me and to one another. So I came forward with my mother's letter in my hand, and I asked that her crimes be forgiven and forgotten. I thought that if she was rehabilitated, she would be allowed to come out of exile and return to China, and I could see her once more. Love is a revolutionary act, I argued. My mother had broken with the old ways, with the suffocating hierarchies of Confucianism, and she had embraced her destiny. What a mistake! I should better have argued that Emperor Hirohito and Chiang Kai-shek deserved a villa in France, paid for by the Communist Party of China. I should have heeded the wise saying, "No flower can bloom for 100 days." Every joke ends. At first, they listened to me and were compassionate. "Brave Edison," they said, "it is right that you show this fidelity to your lost mother. You are a faithful son of the revolution." The 100 Flowers movement was still a spring bouquet, and anything could be said. It was an exciting time, my friend. All of us, young and old, were awakening towards freedom. I felt a deep pride in my country, and I know I wasn't the only one. So, of course, I didn't stop there. I went on about the waste in the village bureaucracy, the favors and bribes that bankrupted the poor, the laughable quality of our scientific education, even the quality of our trains. With all the gifts of our homeland, I proclaimed, we should be the flowering tree of modernity. The anti-rightist campaign began. Everyone with something to lose, from our great helmsman to the local village brute, had heard enough. They summoned me to a meeting in town. I was convinced that my mother had finally arrived, and I would see her again. I spent a fortune on a new set of clothes and a jade necklace for her. A very bourgeois thing to do, I admit. When I arrived at the hall, there were hundreds of people already there. I searched every face for hers. 12 times I thought I saw her. I heard my name echoing on the loudspeaker. It was as if I was underwater, and my name was breaking apart in the current. 2 cadres pushed me up onto the stage, where a man stood holding my mother's letter. I was ecstatic. I looked all around, convinced she waited behind the curtains. The man waved the letter in my face to get my attention. I tried to focus. The man accused me of bourgeois familial tendencies and gross sympathy for the enemy. "What enemy?" I asked, confused. He slapped my face. Enraged, I tried to grab the letter from his hand, but it ripped. I had to get away, I thought, so that I could find her. She was somewhere in this room. "Ma," I called. "I am here. Where have they put you?" The 2 cadres tied my arms with ropes, as if I was a beast. The crowd began to shout my name and curse me. I thought it was a dream. Someone was bleeding, but it couldn't be me. Someone was being beaten for the edification of the crowd, but surely it wasn't me. I imagined that the letter expanded and covered me, and hid me, and everything became dark. I woke up when they emptied a bucket of water on me. And then I shouted in rage and called them betrayers, monsters, and ghosts. My words touched no one. Instead, they were recorded in a file. This is how I know what was said, because the words have been repeated back to me so many times since then. I was carted away to Jia Bian Guo. For months, I simply refused to believe that I was there. Men whose only crime was honest criticism were digging ditches and wasting away. Meanwhile, back home, their families lived in ignominy. Their kids were hounded in schools or kicked out altogether. Their houses were confiscated, their possessions trashed, their wives forced to beg on the streets, empty the public toilets and denounce their own husbands. We could protest all we wanted, but it made no difference. The guards told us we were lucky that not only had we been spared execution, but we had a roof over our heads and shoes on our feet. There are many stages to hunger. By 1959, they were burying us by the truckload. The cold, young sparrow, was metallic, bitter, and had appetites of its own. The cold crawls into your body and destroys you from the inside. Even the camp leaders told us not to waste our last days on this earth digging ditches. So we were free. Free to wander the desert in search of something to eat. When the dreamer used to say it was like searching an empty pocket for coins. Still, we persevered. There were times when the only thing we carried back after an entire day of scavenging was each other. Nothing in our stomachs but an echo. One weighed no more than a 10-year-old child. Often we didn't have the energy to return to the caves, and so we slept, unsheltered, in the open. When he was weak, we sat so close, our heads touched. He would pick up the story he'd been telling me as if he'd just set it down a moment ago, as if he had only to close his eyes and find the right page. His chest had caved in. His eyes had grown frighteningly large, and his bones were knives. But I think one was most afraid of silence. Again and again, he told me that his daughter was the light of his days, and his wife was the center of his world. I couldn't help but fall in love with her, too. Every lovely thing in the air was his beloved swirl. The turquoise sky, sand that shimmered like stars, the sunlight that touched our rough skins. He spoke to her at night as if she was seated beside us. When he had a fever, he would crawl out of the cave determined to find food for her. Once I saw him washing grains of sand in a pot of water, convinced that he was cleaning the rice for his suffering swirl. But even mad, he could tell stories. Maybe he told them better than in saner days, I wouldn't know. We swore never to leave one another, because the worst fate would be to feel abandoned in this frozen and beautiful world. It is one thing to suffer, another thing to be forgotten. Later on, he rarely spoke his wife's name. Instead, he occupied himself by telling a story that had no beginning and no end, and that was born of the revolution. One of the characters, May 4th, reminded me very much of my own mother. May 4th leaves her life and disappears into the wilderness. Meanwhile, Da Wei searches for his family across the ocean and the desert. One could divide their lives into pieces and distribute them over 100 days or over 1,000. One day, I recognized myself in the story. There was suddenly a young man who made glass eyes for a living. I felt most at ease, most himself, among the partially sighted and the blind. I also began to recognize the lives of our fellow inmates in Jiabian Guo. I heard the echo of their star-crossed loves and youthful dreams. In the end, I never knew how much Wen the Dreamer made up, or how much was a part of the original book he had memorized. Perhaps no one knows, but the author himself. Even Wen has lost track of where he begins and where the story joins him. He has become far more than a skilled calligrapher. The year of the rat arrived. It was 1960. Strings were pulled by a childhood friend of my mother who had heard of my case and worked discreetly to have me freed. I was unexpectedly resurrected. I was literally brought back to life because in a few months' time there would be almost no rightists left. Professors, thinkers, and scientists, leaders who had taken part in the long march, grandfathers who had spilled blood for the party, good men, weak men, honest and conniving men, bachelor men, and men with a dozen desperate children. They were no more. Our great communist community turned away as these human beings were ground to dust. I had to leave, even if it meant breaking my promise and abandoning Wen. The last time I saw him, your uncle told me that he had made a plan of escape. I actually left. Getting out was impossible. He might as well have made a plan to turn Mao Zedong into Charlie Chaplin. I told him his ragged clothes weighed more than he did. Worse, there was nowhere to go. The party guarded the train station as if it were a storehouse of gold. "But I am not gold," he said. "Then what are you, my friend?" "Just a copy of a copy, a migrating soul." He was mad, I thought, and soon would leave this world. This was the only escape open to him. I hid my grief, and I said to him, "One day, the anti-rightist campaign in Jiabian Guo will be common knowledge, the way the Boxer Rebellion and the Long March are written into our books and our memories. My brother, we will not be abandoned by history." Wen said to me, "That will not happen in our lifetimes, nor the lifetime of this stone beneath my foot." Then he looked down at the ground on which there were no visible stones, only dry grass and splintered branches. Who was right? It's too soon to say. There was no one around us. There was not even a breeze. There was no one to overhear me, but I had gotten into the habit of whispering. But what could I say that was honest and true? What had I learned in these 3 terrible years? Did I know more about living or dying? "Wen," I said, "this country exists in fear. I am a rationalist and a scientific man. I believe the rules of life become ever more intricate. There are unseen wires from each to each that we cannot see. Not yet. We are here to learn and not to forget. Here to question and not to answer. You are a man of questions. Of all the destinies of the world, this is a heroic one, and yet it carries suffering, for it is hard to live with so little certainty. Why were we sent here to Jiabian Guo? Whose purpose did it serve? For I believe it must serve some purpose. We are the builders of the revolution, and also its scapegoats. Escape is the only answer, Wen said. Escape is death. Wen smiled. He had wasted away. If he lay down to rest his head, I feared he might never rise again. He said, I would never walk knowingly to my death. He showed me his suitcase. Written on the inside of the lining were the names of all the men who had died, and the dates of their falling. It is, I believe, the only accurate record that exists. He told me he had a plan to do something more. He would take the names of the dead and hide them, one by one, in the Book of Records, alongside May 4th and Da Wei. He would populate this fictional world with true names and true deeds. They would live on, as dangerous as revolutionaries, but as intangible as ghosts. What new movement could the party proclaim that would bring these dead souls into line? What crackdown could erase something that was hidden in plain sight? This is my fate, Wen the dreamer told me. To escape and continue this story, to make infinite copies, to let these stories permeate the soil, invisible and undeniable. And so he escaped. Comrade Glasseye said, with a suitcase, I am sure, and convinced of his destiny.
He wiped his eyes.
I am glad Wen the dreamer sent you to me, but I wonder which story he wanted you to hear. You know how it is. Pull one thread and the whole curtain unravels.
He wanted me to hear just the story you told, Sparrow said. I am sure of it.
There is the engineer we called Gai Ge, and also the former soldier Paper Gun.
He waved at the air as if the two men were standing beside him.
I was given the name Comrade Glasseye. Perhaps that is the lesson the party wanted us to learn. In our basic needs, air, water, food, and shelter, nothing separates the doctor from the flea, the educated from the ignorant. So, in fact, I was re-educated after all. I learned this lesson all too well.
Across the clear morning, Sparrow could see Kai bringing water to the garden, ladling it out with a small container.
If you had to guess, where do you think my uncle might have gone?
Wen the dreamer has no identity papers, and he has, therefore, little room to maneuver.
The old man shook his head.
He is a refugee in his own country. There are two routes that I can see. Either the northern journey of May 4th into the desert, or across the ocean, like Da Wei. Which would your uncle choose?
Neither. He will not leave my aunt's whirl or Zhu Li.
Agreed. Regardless of his trajectory, you will hear from him.
Yes, Sparrow said. He can't prevent himself from putting pen to paper.
The old man laughed.
He seemed to emit light for a moment, and then the light wavered and dimmed.
Come, Comrade Glasseye said. I think your friend has recovered from last night's festivities. He is ready to continue playing music for us, and I'm ready to rest my feet and close my eyes, bend my head, and listen attentively. I remember now that Wynn the Dreamer always began his stories with the greeting, Kan Guan, dear listener.
That same day, while practicing Prokofiev's Violin Sonata No. 2, Zhu Li could not stop thinking about her parents. Had Swirl and Big Mother Knife reached Gansu province? What was the probability that her father would come across an altered copy of the Book of Records? It was as likely, Zhu Li thought, as her being invited to play Prokofiev before Chairman Mao and the villagers of Bingpai. She had been just a child then, only 6 years old, when she discovered the underground library. Sitting alone, frozen by the winter sun, she had seen a stranger emerging from the soil. His head had seemed to lift from the ground, as if he were crawling out of his own grave. The stranger turned north, his long baggy body melting into the trees. Zhu Li had stood, peering after him. Was he an escaped convict, or just a stranger passing through? Maybe it was the ghost of her great-grandfather, Old West. Zhu Li went to investigate. After the land reform had been achieved, after they had been assigned the mud brick house, Zhu Li had been expelled from the village school. The child of a disgraced landlord, the Peasants' Association decided, should study the textbook of the fields and the equations of the sky. Besides, she already knew how to read, and should no longer take up precious space. With nowhere to go and no one to play with, Zhu Li had tried to stay with her parents in the fields, but she got in the way of the plow and cut her feet on the sharp rice stalks. Her mother, exasperated, yelled at her to go home. She obeyed, but inside the hut, the loneliness became unbearable. Zhu Li decided to investigate the spot where the old man had emerged. Crouching in the shade of a gnarled tree, she saw a clean, dark stone, and, beneath it, flattened grass and a branch worn smooth. It was a handle. She lifted the trap door. There was a rope with knots. She was small, and even in her bulky, padded coat, climbed down easily. In some ways, this hidden space was more comfortable than the bare room in which she lived with her parents. It was just below ground, as if a very large and well-made wooden box, a shipping container, had been buried with a living room inside it, like an afterlife for Old West. There was a cushioned chair large enough for 6 Zhu Lis, an imported kerosene lamp, and a full case of oil, stacks and stacks of books, and a soft woven mat on the floor. She lit one of the lamps, and pulling shut the trap door, glimpsed 2 musical instruments, a qin and an erhu, though she hadn't known their names at the time. When she set it on her lap, the qin was heavy and cold. It had a creaking roughness, and, at first, she simply sat with it and stared at the room which, in comparison to the mud house, seemed modern and strange. The crumbling books were from another age. They were literally from another continent, but the heavy qin felt alive. On her lap it seemed to breathe in and out, like the great-grandfather to whom it must have belonged. Zhu Li went down almost every day, even if only for an hour. Over an entire season, she tested the range of the qin's 5 battered strings. She did not know how to tune the instrument, but quickly settled on a harmony that seemed to suit both the strings and herself. Later on,
she learned that the classical guqin was associated with elderly scholars and erudite books. With snakes, conservatives, and reactionaries, her classmates said. And it was true. Old West's qin had made her feel part of a floating darkness. The sounds it made were otherworldly and had more in common with punctuations than with words. At night, Zhu Li slept curled up beside her mother, longing to be in the underground library. She needed to make sure the instrument was still breathing. Truly, it felt as if the old qin was her stronger, braver twin. Spring was late that year, and all the farmers and the hungry people were anxiously watching the ground. An otherwise kind boy named Lu saw her emerge from the soil, just as she had glimpsed the old man. That very day, the container was dug up and all the objects carted off. The books, the soft carpets, and the cushioned chair were confiscated, proof that old West's descendants were biding their time and continued to conceal their wealth. Neighbors whom Zhu Li knew, who always greeted her on the paths and sometimes gave her something small to eat, came and plastered the mud brick house with hastily written denunciations, the words so large they could be read from the road. She knew only a handful of characters, but she recognized the ones for girl, daughter, nü, and sky, tian, which had been linked together to form a single word, witch, yao. That evening, the little hut was very quiet. Zhu Li asked her mother why the word yao was written on their house. Her mother combed Zhu Li's hair and said it was nothing, a small disagreement with the neighbors, and, anyway, what an odd word to recognize. Swirl did something she never did. She mixed a paste of herbs and eucalyptus oil and rubbed the mixture over Zhu Li's arms and legs, gently massaging her arms, legs, feet, fingers, and even her toes. With every circular motion of her mother's fingers, Zhu Li disappeared piece by piece. She remembered the soothing warmth of the kang and her father's suitcase, with its dulled fabric and brass clasps, and a keyhole the size of her pinky. Once she had asked for the key, but he said it didn't exist. Night fell. Into the silence a true demon came. It shouted and raged as if to topple the hut. All at once, there were people everywhere, some holding ropes and even singing. Then hands shoving her aside as she tried to reach her mother, who had been forced to her knees. Swirl was saying, "Pity, pity!" There was a loud clap, and her mother cried out. When the dreamer's voice shook, as if it was coming from the foundations of the little house itself, Zhu Li cried and cried. Was it her screaming that frightened all the demons away? She imagined she was the daughter and sky twisted up, demonic, and all the neighbors were afraid of her now. The men left, half carrying, half dragging her parents with them, as if they too were objects retrieved from underground. And then the room in shambles was silent. She climbed up onto the kang, even though its warmth had dulled. She was afraid to feed coal into its mouth and heat the bed again, so she pulled all the quilts around herself, lay down, and closed her eyes. She asked herself how the underground room could harm anyone, and why knowing of its existence was enough to bring forth demons. No answers came to her. Events were like dreams, she concluded, and thus could not be real. When she awoke from this dream, she told herself the bed would be warm, and her parents would be here, and it would be morning. This time, she would be very careful when she climbed into Old West's buried library. She would smuggle the qin out
and hide it here. Was it still breathing? A day passed, and then another. There was nothing.